Thank you, Roger. I invite you to keep your Bibles open to that story, which we covered about 4 or 5 weeks ago in this very auditorium in the adult class on Sunday morning. I spoke to Reg afterwards, telling him I had a lot of thoughts regarding that I didn't want to put him on the spot, ask some questions that I wasn't able to answer, and I didn't want to put him on the spot to try to answer those. And though we covered this already a few weeks back, I would like to take another look at it and to see what kind of lessons there are for us to apply to our lives to help us be more like Jesus. In the first couple of verses of this, it takes us to this scene of a wedding. And we're told that some of the guests was the mother of Jesus, Jesus himself, and his disciples. I thought it was interesting, and this was one of the thoughts that was running through my mind when Reg was teaching this, that marriage is actually the first institution that God ordained. Long before the church was ever ordained, long before the law of Moses was ever ordained, God ordained marriage. It's the first institution ordained by God. The second chapter of the book of Genesis, verses 18 through 25. I thought also, isn't it interesting that the Creator of man and of woman, the author of matrimony, starts out his miracles at a wedding. It was very fitting that the author of marriage would be at a wedding. I also thought, isn't it interesting that we don't know who the bride was or the groom, but we know who the best man at the wedding was. Jesus is the best man wherever he's at, and certainly at this wedding. His mother says to him in verses 3 and 4, now apparently they know these people, they've been invited to this wedding. And at this time, the wine that had been served had run out. And I don't know if Mary was helping some of those who were serving, but she turns to Jesus and tells him, they're out of wine. That seems like an odd thing to me. And I could see maybe Jesus or you or I saying something, well, it's not my problem. Call the caterer. Who made this big mistake? But apparently there's something about Jesus that makes Mary even turn to him. Jesus is about 30 years old at this point. And about 30 years prior to this, Mary was visited by an angel. I think if I spoke to an angel, I wouldn't even forget that 30 years later. She's been told a number of things about the baby that she would conceive. When he was about 12 years old, he was debating doctors at the temple. And no doubt that a few days prior to this, a few weeks maybe, when he was baptized, I don't know that she was present, but no doubt she heard what had happened at that event. So she knows there is something very unique and special about Jesus. She was told that by the angel 30 years prior to this. Because she says to him, they have no wine. And based upon his answer, she apparently was practically begging him to perform a miracle or to miraculously take care of this. I don't know how she would have known that because there's no sign or evidence that he ever performed a miracle until this time. But she does know that he's special. And his answer to her, mine hour is not yet come. And this was brought out in our class a little bit. Jesus called his supreme sign, the ultimate sign that Jesus did, was him giving his life and then raising back to life. That was the ultimate proof of who he was and what he could do. And apparently, because of that answer, apparently that seems to be what she was alluding to. If you want some references on this, this is a short list of the times that he refers to mine hour. He's referring to his death, burial, and resurrection. John 12, verses 23 and 27. John 17, 1. Matthew 26, 45. Luke 22, 53. And that's a short list. But Mary is asking for a supreme sign, as it were. And he says, no, it's not time for that. But I will give you a secondary sign. And he does. In verse 5, this was just read for us. We could probably end this sermon right here because this is one of the shortest sermons preached in the Bible, and it's one of the most, has the most in it. Mary tells the servants, whatsoever he saith, do it. I could end right here, and we could go home with a powerful lesson. Whatever Jesus says, do it. And again, apparently, Mary seems to know that there's something very special about Jesus. And somehow, some way, this story is contained in 11 verses. And at the very end of this very book, John says, not everything that was recorded that Jesus did, because it couldn't be done. The world couldn't contain the books. So he reduces this story down to 11 verses. And there's got to be a lot going on here, because apparently by what he said and how he said it or something, she knew by that answer somehow that he was going to do something. So she instructs the people, whatever he tells you to do it, do it. There are 6 water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews. And as was read from Roger's version, 20 to 30 gallons, this is disputed as to how much this was. We encounter this in our own lives when we use that kind of measuring. Someone that's got the name for that can help me out here. But others use the metric system. So sometimes we think of quarts and gallons, and other people in their measuring systems thinks of liters and so forth. Well, firkins, I'm not sure what was, but apparently those who have studied this, it translates into somewhere between 20 and 30 gallons. I want to make an observation here, and this may seem way out of context. This is why I didn't want to make these kind of comments when Reg was teaching, because I wasn't sure if any of I could even connect all the dots here. But this miracle was done in earthen vessels. 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, verse 7, Paul speaking of the gospel and it being laid to his trust along with the other apostles, says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. Then I thought another thought about Jesus on a very different occasion, trying to make a different point in a sermon, used this illustration in the 9th chapter of Matthew, verse 17. It says, neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. Historians tell us that the wine bottles of that day were made typically of goat skin. And in that point that he's trying to make, that if you used an old bottle, because it's dried up and it doesn't expand, if you put new wine into that bottle, it would bust as the wine would expand and ferment. The only reason I'm bringing this out, stone pots is not the typical thing to put wine in. And I'll just leave that thought with you because we'll come back to it. He tells them in verse 7 to fill the water pots. Now, again, this story is told to us in 11 verses. There was not a sink with running water, as you and I know. When we go downstairs in a few moments to eat our basket dinner, so those of us who are used to this, there's 5-gallon containers that we put our water and our tea and our Kool-Aid in. They're pretty heavy when they're filled up. If we go with the lowest number here of 20 gallons, these would have been pretty big containers. And I don't know what had to happen here. I don't know if they had to go a little ways down the road to the nearest well or the nearest river. I don't know. We're not told that in the story. These are pretty large containers. And however they filled them up or wherever they filled them up, it would have taken a little bit of time. It would have probably taken at least 2 people to carry that. None of this is recorded for us, but I just want you to ponder that. There was some effort put forth here in obeying what Jesus had them do. They filled these pots clear to the brim. And Reg pointed this out when he was teaching. Nothing else could have gone in there. They were filled. It emphasizes the great quantity when we read about Jesus feeding 5,000 people and they still collected 12 baskets of leftovers. It's kind of that same principle going on here. There would be a minimum of 120 gallons of wine. There's no room to add anything. And I think there's a very basic element here. We've talked about it a bit already. Jesus gives the orders, we follow, not the other way around. They're following what Mary had said. Whatever he says, do it. Now, they had a little bit to do in following Jesus' orders to fill up 20-gallon containers with water. They didn't have a sink or a garden hose to do that with. They put forth quite a bit of effort on their part, which I think is a lesson in and of itself. Human cooperation with the Lord is taught all throughout the Bible. He doesn't do for us what we can do for ourselves. You may recall when Jesus raised the daughter of Jairus, recorded in Matthew or Mark, the 5th chapter, verse 43. He did what only he could do. He raised her from the dead. But then he told them to give her something to eat. When he brought forth Lazarus from the grave, John, the 11th chapter, verse 44. That's God's part. That's the part that only God can do. But he still had them take off the grave clothes. God doesn't do for us what we can do. He does for us what only He can do. But there's things for us to do, as demonstrated in this miracle. And they did it, as Mary advised, and things went the way they should have. Verse 8. Draw out now. Now these people had gone through a lot of effort, it would seem to me, to carry these water containers wherever they had to carry them, to fill them up with water. They knew what was in them. They filled them up. He tells them to draw out. And then when they make this draw out of there, they take it to the master of ceremonies there. But at this point, apparently, it seems to indicate that's when it changed. from water to wine. Draw out now. They take it to the master of ceremonies, and he knew nothing about this. Now, he may have known Jesus. I don't know. We're not told in the story. But even if he did know him, he didn't know what had just transpired. He didn't know that any of this had gone on. It says he knew not whence it was. And I think this is important because whether he knew him or didn't know him, his judgment was unbiased. And if he would have known all this, then his judgment wouldn't have been impartial. But he didn't know any of this had gone on. So he can't say, well, I like this guy, Jesus, so I'm going to render a favorable judgment. Or, you know, I don't think I like this guy, so he didn't know anything about it. Which is key. And what we do know is that as soon as he tastes this wine, he recognizes it being superior to what was already served. Very superior. In fact, he's struck by that. He thinks, this is unusual. This is not normal. Normally, you get the good stuff, and then when everybody's a little tipsy or whatever, and your taste buds aren't as sharp, you can't really tell the difference between the cheap and the good stuff. But he could. He could tell instantly that this was superior to what had already been served. And he makes that judgment. And it's an unbiased, impartial judgment. And he says in verse 10, "Thou hast kept the good wine until now." B.W. Johnson, in his commentary, The People's New Testament, had this to say, and I thought it was pretty good. "Satan gives the good wine first, so the drunkard finds it. Afterwards, he gives the bitter, red eyes, pain, addiction, and wretchedness." J.W. McGarvey made this observation in his commentary. "It is a part of Christ's system to reserve the best until the last. Sin's first cup is always the sweetest, but with God, that which follows is ever superior to that which has preceded it." And even this man, who's not necessarily a follower of Jesus, recognized this is not the normal way of doing things. The 11th verse, which is the end of the story, we're told that this is the beginning. "This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee." Another one of my random thoughts that was running through my mind when Reg was teaching this a few weeks back. Why I was afraid to say anything, because I wasn't even sure of these thoughts and if there was really any connection. This was the beginning of Jesus' miracles. Now, it's not the beginning of his ministry. That was a few weeks prior to this when he was baptized. But this is kind of the thoughts that were striking me, that all these beginnings began with water. Genesis, the first chapter, verse 2. "And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." The Bible begins with water. Jesus began his ministry with water that he was baptized into. He began his ministry or his miracles with this element, water. The value of the miracle was in really what it signified rather than what it actually produced. I suppose that 120 gallons of wine is more valuable than 120 gallons of water. But the value, The value of the miracle was in what it signified. Because it goes on to say in verse 11, this beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory. It manifested the glory of Christ. Part of the glory of Christ is his power to make these kinds of changes. Part of the glory of Christ is for him demonstrating his ability to take something simple and make it into something more complex and rich. His power to change the worse into the better. It demonstrates his power to transform sinners into his likeness. That's the value of the miracle. And of course, it took human cooperation, or he wanted human cooperation for that to happen. You can just listen to these verses I want to read. If you want to turn there, that's fine too. 2 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter. I'm going to read verse 3 and then verse 18. I told you a moment ago to keep this idea of earthen vessels in your mind. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3. Ye are manifestly declared to be the epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in fleshly tables of the heart. Verse 18 of that same chapter. But we all with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image, from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. Turn over a page into the 5th chapter of 2 Corinthians. Look at verse 5. Now he that hath wrought us for the selfsame thing is God, who hath given unto us the earnest of the Spirit. Verse 17. If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. That's what this miracle demonstrates. Jesus can take and change something from worse into something much better. Something simple into something richer. Look at the elements. Began with these water pots containing water for purifying. Jesus' mother saying, whatever he says, just do it. Jesus tells them to draw out. And that which was drawn out was richer than that which was put in. And we have that demonstrated every time somebody is baptized. That which is drawn out is richer than what was put in. Because as these verses that we just read from 2 Corinthians, he's transforming us into his likeness. But it all starts with water. As it did in the beginning, as it did in the beginning of Jesus' ministry, as it did in the beginning of his miracles. For those of you who got a program, Felicia put on that a verse out of the book of Revelations, and I would like for you to turn there. The very last book of the Bible, the very last chapter of the Bible. We've already pointed out that the Bible opened up with this element of water. It ends with the element of water. Chapter 22 of Revelation, verses 1 and 2, "And he showed me a pure river of water, of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations." Drop down to verse 17. "And the Spirit and the bride say, Come. And let him that heareth say, Come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely." That's the last invitation given in the Bible. But every time we meet, typically, we offer or we extend Christ's invitation. It all begins with water. The Ethiopian eunuch came upon water and said, "See, here's water. What doth hinder me to be baptized? Behind me is a pool of water." And if you're here this morning, you begin your walk with God with water. And as you're drawn out, you'll be drawn out richer than what you were when you were put in. Just as he did with this first miracle. If you'd like that kind of a miracle to take place in you, we'd like to be witnesses of it. And we'd like to be participants in it. If you're here this morning and you haven't done that, would like to start a new beginning, let's start it with water as we sing the song that's been announced.